My name's Steve Lord. I'm going to be talking about XFS. Maybe 60-40 between what XFS is in terms of what features it has and how it works and what we've had to do to get into Linux. So I'll talk first a bit about why we're doing this. Then I'll move into features of XFS, some of how it works. I'll try not to replicate what went before yesterday. And differences in the interfaces between the file system and the rest of the OS between Linux and IRIX, which is where most of the work ends up being. Little bit about page buffs, which is some work we've been doing for file buffering and metadata buffering. Where we are and where we're going from here. So, first of all, obviously we want it to be GPL because we want this to go into Linux's tree at some point. We're not exactly sure when that's going to happen, but someday it'll happen. And single source base between IRIX and Linux was an initial goal as well. There is 120,000 lines thereabouts of code in the kernel with XFS. A lot of that's comments. I haven't gone in and attempted to say there's this many actual lines of real C code. So we really don't want to have multiple different versions of this stuff. We want to keep as much of it the same as possible. Then the other important thing is we want to be able to move file systems backwards and forwards between MIPS, IRIX boxes, and Linux. So, first of all, the legal end of things. I mean, SGI announced open sourcing of XFS, I don't even remember, like, way long time ago. Sometime early-ish last year. And I really wish we hadn't told the lawyers, because it was horrible. SGI's legal people insisted that we don't do anything which might get the company sued. So basically, a group of very brave people in Australia took the source code and they went and collected other source bases, I mean AT&T, System 5, all sorts of stuff, and generated all sorts of tools for doing comparison between the different trees and looking for matches. And when they did find one, we had to take it out and replace it. And they found four or five. Very, very little. I mean, the whole core of XFS didn't look like anybody else's code. So basically, it let them learn the code. It also got rid of two lawyers, and it took way too long to do. Okay, source code compatibility. Obviously, common code base. The two reasons, really. A, the cost of maintaining two, and B, if we have to change everything to make it work on Linux, then chances are we're going to break a lot of it in the process. So it's really fairly key to us that we try and keep the core of the code the same and deal with stuff around the edges. Now, unfortunately, at the same time, over the last few years, IRIX didn't have a very good reputation for reliability, and they really clamped down on code going into that thing now. Which means the people who look after that say, no way, no how, are you changing our code just so it'll work on Linux? So, at the moment, we have a lot of changes in our code which aren't in Linux, maybe in IRIX, maybe they'll go in there someday, but not for now. But we've tried to do things in a way where we can go back. And then finally, from the external messages we get, are like, keep it clean, don't do stuff to Linux which is going to help you but hurts everybody else, basically. And just quickly through this, it's probably not very interesting to most of the people in here. The on-disk formats, is now exactly the same. Once the people in Australia had finished reviewing the code, they then went and did an Endian conversion on the thing, because MIPS is big Endian, and our first platform, the I-32, is little Endian, so they again did all the work on that end of things, which was very nice, because I didn't want to do it. And obviously we need to understand the volume managers from Rx. If we can just support single disks, it's not very interesting. So that is in progress as a totally separate project. And finally, we're going to have to make the system calls look the same somehow, probably through a library layer. So, on to some more interesting stuff. What's actually in Earthquake? No. In XFS? Well, first of all, some not very useful these days file size limitations. 2 to the 64 is kind of, well, 2 to the 63 minus 1 for files, 2 to the 64 for file systems is kind of not used practically at the moment. Who knows? Someday it may be. But there are restrictions in Linux which pull us down from that. I've managed to create a file with a size of 2 to the 43 minus 1. So the LFS stuff that's out there, this was on the Red Hat 6.2, so the user space LFS stuff does work. Which you can create a public file that big. I wouldn't recommend catting it, though. It's like, because I don't have that much disk space. I just put a few bytes out at the end. When you make an XFS file system, you get to pick the block size of the file system. This is the unit of allocation. So when you're allocating directory blocks, when you're extending a file, this is the smallest chunk of stuff it will allocate. And that goes anywhere from 512 bytes to 64 kilobytes. And 64 kilobytes is just for people who always deal with huge files, and there's no pointing them messing around with small stuff. Default's 4 kilobytes. And we are completely extent-based. There was a couple of bitmaps lying around one or two places, but free space is managed as extents. In-use space in files is all managed in extents. So an extent is basically a tuple of file offset, disk block location, and length. And free space, I'll get into a bit of detail there, free space is actually organized as two B-trees, one of which is organized by location on disk, and one of which is organized by size. So depending on what your first priority is when you're trying to allocate space, you can search one way or the other. So if you want to put stuff close to something else, you go into the location search. If you want to get something contiguous, then you go into the size-based one. I couldn't attempt to draw a picture of what the whole of XFS looks like on disk, but basically we can have three sub-volumes. You can split your file system up into three different sub-components. Data, which is the main part of the file system, and that's metadata, file data, free space, everything's in there. The log is just a circular journal. And then we have this real-time sub-volume, which is only used for file data. There's no metadata in there at all. And Rx volume managers let you build a volume which has got named sub-volumes within it. And on Rx, you can say makefs on the volume name, and it'll glue everything together. Martin down here did some work on Linux to let us pass in separate names for different subcomponents. But in the case where you are just using a single disk partition, then you don't bother with real time, and basically the log gets put in the middle of the data subvolume. So for the simple case, none of this comes into play. Then the data subvolume is split into allocation groups. This is the unit of management of space, if you like. Each of these maintains its own free space, its own inode structures, what have you. And you can have one CPU allocating space in one of these while another CPU is freeing space in another one. So it's also a multi-threading thing. Those are, well, if you made a file system on a 9-gig drive, they'd probably come in as about a gigabyte each. And they are limited to a 4-gig size. So when we get to really big file systems, we get to have thousands of them. That actually gets to be a problem when you want a multi-terabyte file system. And people are working on that. And the other thing it lets us do is we can add more of them. So if you have a volume manager which lets you add space to a volume, then on the fly you can grow the file system, create new allocation groups, and then people can start putting data in them. So when we're actually allocating space, the normal case is delayed allocation, or as it seems to be getting called in the Linux community, allocate on flush. So there is, when you do a write in XFS, there's no transaction. There's in-memory structures which represent the amount of free space available, and you just subtract from the amount of free space, you tag it onto the file, and there's an in-memory representation of an extent which doesn't have a physical dislocation yet. And then later on, due to memory pressure or sync activity or something else, this gets flushed out to disk. And at that point, we do the allocation, so you coalesce multiple write calls into a single allocate request. And this helps a lot for creating contiguous files. We also support pre-allocation, so you can, if you know in advance what your application is going to be using in terms of space, then you can pre-lay out the space in advance and get all the transactions out of the way, and you can just push the data straight into it when you actually write it. Tends to go together with direct I/O, where you're moving directly between user memory and the device and not going through the buff cache. And the other thing here is the allocator is fairly smart. It knows about striping. So if you had a striped file system, then it attempts to lay out extents on stripe boundaries. So that tends to give you better throughput. Now, if you had four drives on four controllers striped correctly, then you could basically have all four of them going full speed ahead at once. And file extents and inodes get laid out on those boundaries in a striped file system. There's other stuff in there for placements. And for the simple file system case, it tries to keep file data close to the inode and file inodes in the directory close to the directory, but it spreads directories around. So it tries to put a subdirectory somewhere else, just so that you don't end up with everything in one part of the file system. Okay, so we too dynamically allocate inodes. Usually it's two file system blocks worth, and because they're variable size, that gives you a different number of inodes depending on how you made the file system, but they're anything from 256 bytes to 4 kilobytes each. And there's a fixed core, which looks fairly normal. And then the other part of it gets used for various things. You can put file extents in there to avoid having indirect blocks for that. You can put directories in there for small directory entries in there for small directories. And you can put these symlinks go in there. You can put extended attributes in there. So these are basically name equals value text type objects. Code's pretty much the directory code. Yeah? It's per file system. It's a MakeFS option. Yeah, so you can't change it on the fly. So it's only really used for people who know in advance what type of data they're going to be putting in there, and they want to, for instance, people who are extremely concerned about I/O speed don't want to have heads flying around the place doing block lookups for bits of metadata. So they try and organize things so a lot of their directory contents and extents would stay in the inode rather than being scattered around. So that way more of the head seeking time is spent going through your data rather than your metadata. Yeah?
This extended attribute for Ted Cho was saying yesterday how bad an idea he thinks it is to have data forks and resource forks. What difficulties have you encountered over the years in IREX in having extended attribute forks?
To be honest, they don't get used by applications in IREX too much. If people have been writing GNOME or something on there, then maybe they would have started sneaking stuff in there. Most of the use that's actually made of them is these things down the bottom, which are system-managed objects. So access control lists, capabilities, and data migration information, where there's a tertiary storage system sitting behind the file system where the extents are no longer there, the data is actually sitting on a tape somewhere, and when you actually come to want to look at it, the system has to go get it for you. That code is actually starting to go into our open source tree at the moment, so DMAPI support is coming. Whoops. Come back. Okay, next. This is just a picture of that. So, as I said, fixed inode core, and then there's these two variable-sized chunks of data in there. The attribute fork is usually empty. Most of the time, we don't actually have anything down there. So all the space gets taken up by directory contents, etc. And then once stuff doesn't fit in there, it starts migrating out into indirect block structures. Okay, I already said B-trees. So directories are organized that way, extents are organized that way, free space. Those extended attributes, if you have too many of them, so on and so forth. We are extremely multi-threaded. IREX is currently running on up to 512 CPU boxes, so that's single system image across 512 CPUs. XFS runs on that. It also runs on this laptop here. So, and as I said before, can handle multiple parallel applications. Now, this real-time subsystem is something which the code is there, but we're not doing anything with it at the moment. That lets you do a much more deterministic type of I.O. The whole point of real-time is you need to be able to give guarantees about how long it takes to do something. So the real-time subsystem actually has its own allocator. It does its own space allocation, and it's a much more deterministic algorithm that's used. And it's also extremely difficult to fragment files out there. We have to change the code to make it fragment files. But what goes with that is it's wasteful of space. I mean, this is for big stuff. This is for, I don't know, MP3s, I suppose, in this in this audience. Just a quick run through of what happens to a directory. When you create a directory, nothing in it. You start putting entries in it, they live inside the inode. Once that gets too big for that, we move it out into a single block of directory entries. And once you go beyond that, it starts building a B-tree. The actual directory entries only live at the bottom, and everything above that is hash value, block address pairs. So you hash your name, and you can walk down the levels of the tree until you find the specific entry at the bottom. And for the sake of stuff like get dents, all the leaves at the bottom are connected together, so you can just walk left or right across the thing. And if you start removing stuff from a directory, then it actually does collapse back again. So you can actually go all the way back from a B-tree back to everything being inside the inode. And extents do exactly the same thing. Okay, so on to journaling, which I haven't said anything about yet. That's the other feature of XFS, is it's another one of these journal file systems. So we do the same thing as everybody else. Basically, we write to the log, and then we write the metadata out. So we have the right ordering requirements that one must happen before the other. Transactions themselves are asynchronous, so you can actually complete, most transactions complete without having to write anything. So they get batched up the same way as EXT3, which we talked about yesterday. And let me see, we're different from EXT3 in that we only log deltas of what's changed. So if you manipulate a directory block and you happen to just put one entry into it, then all that happens is you log the chunk around that. I mean, it chops it up into fixed size pieces, I think. So there's actually quite a lot of compression that goes on in the data. And a number of the structures that we log aren't actually copies of blocks. There are inodes go out differently. Freeing stuff is dealt with differently. So the log is not just a copy of the metadata. And then, whoops, oh well. Okay, the other aspect here is that you mount the file system, it always looks at the log when you mount the file system, but if it finds the last thing in the log is an unmount record, then that's it. If it's not an unmount record, then it has to go find the head and the tail of the log and replay it. And again, as with EXT3, and I'm sure JFS, this is a multi-stage process. There's stuff in there which you don't want to really replay because something else happened later, which reuse those disk blocks. But it's usually pretty fast. Yeah.
Well, I asked if this was done by the mount code as opposed to a user space application.
Yeah, this is within the mount code in the kernel. So the next several slides are actually a kind of sequence of events of what happens as we go through a transaction. And there's a lot of steps missed out here because it's really a lot more complicated than this. But so the first few things you do are reserve log space, and that's where you get stuck if things are busy. I mean, basically, you're not allowed to do anything until there's space in the log to do the worst case version of what you're trying to do. There's a lot. Doing something like a directory update, the range of amounts of data involved is very large. From the worst case of just updating something in the inode to having a 5-level deep B tree and you're splitting the thing and it's going all the way up, and you've got to go and allocate some free space, and that involves another B tree split, so it gets big. So once that's happened, then you obtain, lock, and modify all of your metadata. So that's what other files, that's what EXT2 does, that little bit there. The next thing after that is when we commit the transaction, the deltas get copied into these in-core log buffers. There's several of these. It's a mount option how many you get. And that's basically... Oh, I jumped forward again. That's basically it for the transaction. We pin the metadata in memory. This is the XFS terminology for this. Everybody has their own journaling technology, but we basically stick a pin through the stuff, and it's not nothing will write it out to disk until we unpin it. And then we unlock it, which means other transactions can come along and again modify the metadata again. So next step is this stuff goes out to disk, triggered by a number of different events in the system. One is we run out of in-core log space. Those buffers are 32 kilobytes each, and think 2 is the default. You can have up to 8. And probably for really large systems, we need to increase that. But one transaction can fill more than all of them. It can actually involve going around through the buffers multiple times in those worst-case scenarios. Usually, several transactions fit in one buffer. So running out of space, synchronous transactions, for example, an O underbar sync write, which allocates space, you have to push the transaction out to disk at that point. And finally, just background sync activity, so like the once every 5 seconds type of thing. Once that write completes, we actually need to keep track of all the metadata which is in memory, modified, but not on disk yet. So there's this thing called the active item list, which is basically a chain of all that metadata. And we can now unpin it. So now the metadata could be written to disk. And obviously this list is organized by... It's time organized, but which also means it's log position organized. Then we push the metadata out. So once again, flush, running out of memory, or we don't have any disk log space left. You've basically you're dirtying metadata faster than it's getting flushed out by sync. In that case, we need to do what we call tail pushing, which is you go find the oldest metadata and you force a flush on it. You force it out to disk. And at that point, it goes out to disk. When that I/O completes, it gets taken off this active item list. And if it happened to be at the end, we can move the tail of the log and free up more log space, which means the next guy can come through the transaction. The start of the transaction goes, and we carry on. There's other things going on in here. If we happen to log a piece of metadata, and then we log it again before it's gone out to disk, then we just re-log it back into the log again. We put it back at, we move it to the tail of the active item list. To the head of the active item list. If it happens with the tail, we free some log space. So, again, as Stephen Tweedy mentioned yesterday, quite a bit of commonly used metadata just keeps floating around the log and doesn't go to disk very often at all. Okay, on to what we had to do going to Linux. So IRIX is vNode-based. Linux isn't. And IRIX has a buffer cache interface where you get to mess with variable-sized buffers rather than the fixed-size buffer heads, which Linux uses. And block device interface looks different. System call interface looks different. And then there is some 64-bittedness, if you want to call it that. So because we wanted to keep as much of the code the same as possible, we introduced this glue layer, which is basically mapping from the Linux VFS operations to the vNode operations, if you like. Most of what it's doing is argument translation, but it lets us keep a lot more of the structures looking the same. The other thing it gives us is it can support stacking. You could stack different sets of operations, one on top of the other. And this is a different stacking than other software available for Linux gives you, because this is on a per inode basis. So we can say, we want to stack that one, not everything in the whole file system. We put this in there for CXFS, which is a clustered version of XFS, which needs to interpose itself between the user and the file system. The other thing I have to say here is that the Linux VFS does more than the IRIX VFS. There's a lot more common. Over time, I've watched so much code move out of the file systems and up to the VFS layer. And we still have duplication. Things like renaming a directory into a child of itself is one example of a thing you don't want to happen in the file system. And in Irix, that's handled by the file systems. In Linux, it's handled by the VFS. And now in XFS and Linux, it's handled by the VFS layer. So we are working our way through those as we find them. I'm sure there's several left. I haven't really thought about that one, to be honest. Another option, at the moment I can't remember the name of the package. Yeah. I mean, possibly it's an extension to FIST. I mean, that would be another way to go with this, because FIST, as I understand it, is you get the option of stacking everywhere or stacking nowhere, basically. Okay. So this is a picture of what that looks like. It's pretty. So the over to the left we have the Linux world. So the file ops, the inode ops. I didn't show the dir entry ops. And what's left of our vnode is actually the file system dependent portion of the Linux inode now. And then that points at the behavior, which is in the same structure as the XFS inode itself, and it's the behavior which supports this stacking concept. So you can layer those, they chain together. Okay, missing system calls. There's all these twiddly bits in XFS which you can't really get to through the standard Linux system call interface. So here's a few examples of that. Space pre-allocation, you need to be able to put space into a file and take it out again. There is a POSIX spec for this one there, so I suspect that's the way that one will go. Extended attributes, there's no system calls for those yet. We are actually putting the IRIX ones into our tree, but it sounds like there's going to be some sort of interface in Linux in the near future, and obviously that's the way that'll end up being done. But for now, we need a way of exercising the code in the kernel, so we have to put something in the short term. And there's other extensions to that. If we want to do the access control lists and mandatory access control and capabilities and stuff, there are system call interfaces for that, but there is also a boatload of user space stuff that goes with that type of thing. I think all of the kernel, the actual Mac access checking code is not in our tree. But we have the hooks in the file system, and that code has actually been published by, the code that XFS uses in IRIX has been published by SGI elsewhere. So the kernel code is just a matter of gluing things together. And the other thing here is real-time inode attributes. If you want to use the real-time subsystem, then you have to tell the file system about it, and you need to be able to set things like, say, what is the unit of allocation? You might want to say, whenever I allocate this space in this file, allocate in chunks of half a megabyte. That type of operation. Okay. This is where things get a little bit more hairy. On the IA32. The inode number, which is used by most of the kernel to identify a particular file, is a 32-bit quantity. Well, in XFS, our inode numbers are 64 bits, and the inode number is actually an encoding of the disk location. And it doesn't become a problem until the file system is bigger than 2 terabytes. So at the moment, we haven't dealt with this. But Alviro was suggesting we use some sort of dynamic generation of numbers in place of our inode. So we'd like have fake inodes on top of the real inode numbers. To be honest, I don't like that. And these things really have to be permanent. I mean, people can stat them out of the kernel and record them somewhere else and come back and expect them to be the same later. So they need to be they need to really map onto exactly what the kernel is using. So if anyone's got any bright ideas, the other one is, next one is device addressability. 2 terabytes is still the block device addressability limit. Again, for large systems, we'd like to be able to go beyond that, and hopefully the KAO buff interface is going to give us ways for dealing with that. Another one which actually came up yesterday talking to the JFS guys is directory offsets. These, again, can be a 64-bit quantity. They're used on the getDense system call. So when the getDense gives you back data from the kernel, it gives you an offset to go with it. And you could seek, in theory, to that offset and go back to where you were. Now, glibc has a different size Derrance structure than the kernel does, and it does these interesting things where it takes the user's buffer and says, aha, I know that the kernel structure size is different, so I'm actually going to use a heuristic to say, the user asked for this much, then I'm going to ask the kernel for a different amount because I know that what the kernel will give me won't fit in the user's buffer if I just blindly ask, or potentially won't fit. Now, I can't remember. There's one field which is missing from one and not from the other. I can't remember what it is. But if this heuristic doesn't work, then it does a seek back and tries again. Now, that seek only remembers 32 bits of information, which doesn't really work in all circumstances. And there's other places where the 32 bits becomes an issue. XFS actually has 2 versions of its directory structure to deal with issues like this. The second, what we call V2 directories, this problem doesn't show up until the directory gets really, really, really big, like 2 to the 32. The other one, the directory offset, is actually a hash value. It's not. It doesn't just increment. It wanders around all over the place, but all 64 bits are relevant. That V1 directory format is going to be an issue on Linux unless we can get a patch into glibc. And that doesn't seem to be very easy to do. Okay. So, buffering. So most other file systems in Linux, when they actually want to do I/O, they speak buffer heads. And buffer heads, you get to pick one size. And if you don't do I/O in that size, then the block interface throws it back at you and says, don't do that. Now, in XFS, I said we had a variable block size at MakeFS, but that's not the real problem. The problem is that we have some structures on the disk which are always 512 bytes, and we need to be able to do I/O on them on their own. I mean, for the right ordering, we can't just write the whole 4K block which happens to contain the superblock. We must just write the superblock and not the thing next to it, which might be pinned in memory. So one option would be we do everything in 512-byte pieces. Well, you get an awful lot of buffer heads when you do things that way, and it's pretty expensive. Now obviously, we need to be able to control the right ordering, which doesn't work with the regular buffer interface, and everyone's coming up with their own way of dealing with that at the moment. And then there was this long-term goal we sort of seem to have heard somewhere about moving more and more stuff into the page cache and maybe making buffer heads go away altogether. So we decided to make life interesting for ourselves and do this. So XFS is actually caching everything in pages, and the only times we use buffer heads at the moment are if we're talking to a device which we need to use them on, so they're created temporarily, we do the I/O, we tear them down. And we are currently using for some of the right behind of file data. So we created this thing called page buffs. Page buffs is really two groups of stuff. Can't think of the word. So we cache everything in the file system in pages. So most file systems in 2.4, there's an address space in the inode which caches file data. So file data is just held there. We have a special inode which is for the metadata of the file system with an address space in it. We probably should just have an address space and not the inode. And that's where the metadata lives. Now, we use KO buffs underneath this. So a page buff isn't understood by the I/O layer, but the KO buff is, or will be. So currently it's working for SCSI. There's been some discussion, but Jens is going to do it for IDE. Over there. And Martin is over here is working on the on LVM. And then maybe he'll try MD. And the other thing in here is we do locking on page buffs. So our unit of locking isn't the buffer head or the page, it's the page buff. I mean, page locking still comes into things, but we can lock things of different sizes. So I said there are two parallel parts to this. One is file I/O. As I said, we're extent-based. Now, the set of operations you get for doing I/O to a file are block-based. So when you actually want to ask for space, the interface that's available, you go to the file system and say, give me an address for this block, and then give me an address for the next block, and then the next block, and so on. It doesn't really fit with XFS's model of doing things, so we actually have a parallel set of code, including read and write, for using an extent-based allocator interface. And it understands delayed allocate. We actually currently have our own page cleaner in there, wandering around looking at pages which have this delayed allocate flag in there, and calling back into page buff and saying, okay, time to write this. At which point, we can use the extent-based allocator interface to do I/O clustering. So we can actually go and say, what's next to this? So it's very easy to go to the allocator and say, given this particular offset in the file, give me the range of things which is physically contiguous with it on disk. And from that, we can actually generate a much bigger I/O request. So basically, we use the smart switch the file system has rather than relying on the elevator code. I'm not trying to say the elevator code is no good. It's just we're doing everything twice that way. So, and yeah, this page cleaner should go away and be replaced by parts of the regular VM system. There's discussions going on about that. And I think, have I said everything in here? Okay, at the moment, again, our metadata, we're doing our own management of when it gets written. And that's something else which should move out of this into the regular, the rest of the system. Okay. So, where are we? Despite what the website says, this file system does actually work. For a long time, it said, it's pre-alpha code. Don't touch it with a barge pole, basically. And I think it now says it's pre-beta code. But I use it every day. Okay, unlike Stephen Tweedy, I haven't installed it all over my laptop. I'll do that sometime. I will admit we do have a bug at the moment which causes us not to flush inodes when we should do. I have to put some fairly heavy pressure on the system to make that happen, and once I stop going to conferences, I'll go fix that. So that's IA32. We actually have this up and running on MIPS as well, so it's running on a big and little endian system, and we can mount IRIX disks with that. The other ports are probably going to take a little while yet. The user space code in XFS, for historical reasons, is the kernel code. It's built two different ways. And no Dave Miller in here. Dave Miller, the first day we announced all the code was there, he downloaded it, he attempted to build it on the Spark, and threw up in horror. Sent us a couple of patches and said, no way, no how is this ever going to work? So what's actually been happening is the user space code is still the kernel code, but it is starting to be broken apart. And fairly soon now, we should have a user space which is a separate copy of the code, and we can start cleaning it up. So that should start to make some of the other ports less painful. Most of the utilities are there now, so MakerFS, repair, which is for when things do actually go wrong, because with journal file systems, it doesn't always work. No matter what people say, it doesn't always work. There's I/O errors, all sorts of stuff can happen. Developers getting it wrong, you know, they tend to screw up file systems. That's there. DB is a basically an editor. You can go in and if you can understand the command interface on the thing, you can actually go in and walk around the file system and mess with bits of it. Dump restore, this slide, as up until this morning said, is a work in progress. Last night, they actually did succeed in doing dump and restore. So I don't think that code is out on our website yet. I think they've been holding that one back because it wasn't at all functional, but I expect that to show up in the next day or so. Yeah.
Is it your intention to keep the on-disk compatible between the Linux port of XFS and the original IRIX port of XFS?
Yeah. It's just not worth it to have two different ones. Initially, we were worried about the overhead of byte swapping and that it was going to cost us too much. And so initially, we were a little Endian because it was easier to get the file system going that way without having to worry about the Endian issues. And then it was going to be runtime switchable. But first thing you have to do is make it work the other way around. So do the Endian flipping, and they measured it. It wasn't worth bothering with, so now it's all big Endian. XFS already has several different versions, just like most file systems have, where there's backwards and forwards compatibility stuff in there. And I expect over time other bits and pieces will show up. There's other stuff out there that goes with these tools. Somebody just started working on the defragmenter. IRIX has a defragmenter, which is an online beast, and someone outside of SGI just said, hey, I'd like to work on that. So that's cool.
Is there a resizer?
There is a grower. There isn't a shrinker.
That's fair enough.
shrinking is much harder. And you kind of have to design a file system from the start to cope with that. Mm-hmm.
The grower is far more important.
Yeah. No, that's... I don't think that's there yet, because the last item on this says volume measure interface needs work.
I looked at it at some point, but didn't quite get it going.
It's a very simple... The kernel user space interface is very minimal. It's just like, here's some extra space. Go use it. But on the volume manager front, there's that. There's finding out where the heck the stripes are. While the file system knows about them, you have to get the information from the volume manager into the file system. That's not quite there yet. Yeah. You can actually, if you go and do your research and figure out how the heck the thing's laid out, you can actually make a file system and explicitly specify the options. Okay, check your code in. Yeah. Okay, so where do we go from here? Okay, there's always performance work to do. It's actually pretty reasonable at the moment. I think for Bonnie, we're doing about twice EXT2. If you throw multiple times the amount of memory you have in your system into one file, so like you write a gigabyte file with Bonnie or something. Is that right, Nanth? But there's things we can do yet. There's definitely things we can do yet. So,
what is XFS's performance on many, many small files?
Depends what you're doing with the files.
Can you explain my department is the biology department at Duke University. Mm-hmm. I've got a herd of gene sequencers. Mm-hmm.
Probably want this guy over here. No, I'm not afraid to stand up here and say that RiserFS is going to be better for some things, XFS is going to be better for others. I don't regard this as a competition. There's different horses for different courses, basically. XFS will do okay, but I suspect other file systems will do better.
Mm-hmm. One of the concerns I have is that where it may be interesting to switch to XFS, it's just different. How much change did you have to do to the original code?
Well,
how much would be debugged?
Things we changed inside XFS itself. Well, the interface to buffers was the largest change. We basically encapsulated the IRIX buffer interface and the page buffer interface behind a set of macros. So we had to go all over the code, changing where XFS dived in and out of buffer structures directly. So there's that, but it's pretty much a one-for-one exchange. Because of the way inodes are managed in IRIX compared to how vnodes are... Sorry, inodes in Linux versus vnodes in IRIX... we have some changes in the inode teardown end of things, which is where the bug is. Apart from that, changes are basically taking stuff out, which is done by the VFS layer, and changing system call interfaces at the top. The most important thing is getting the caching behavior exactly right. The core of the code is the same. The algorithms are the same. We haven't had to do drastic surgery in there. So yeah, that was one of the key reasons for keeping the code the same. It's been tested a lot, and we don't want to mess with it. So okay, what else on here? PageBuff and Linux VM integration is going to happen. We're not exactly sure what's going to come out the end of it in terms of what PageBuffs end up looking like, but we are going to get more tightly integrated at that end, which will help with general system behavior. I can make XFS drag a system into the floor, basically, but it's because it's thrashing the disk backwards and forwards just because I'm putting heavy stress on it. But I'm sure you can do that with other file systems as well. But generally, it doesn't grab all the memory in the system or anything like that. It's reasonably well behaved, but we can do better. Real time, as I said, the code is there. The thing that isn't there is the support for it. There's this thing called guaranteed rate I/O, which is basically a reservation mechanism where you say, I want 2 megabytes a second for 2 minutes. And this user space code is responsible for managing that and saying either you got it or you didn't get it. And there's assorted hooks down in the I/O system in IRIX for maintaining those guarantees. Whether those would ever go into general Linux, I'm not sure at all. I doubt. Then there's the volume manager end of things. It's still a work in progress. So that's purely a portability thing. We'll have Linux volume manager support. And then once I've got all that done, we've got all that done. It's not just me. We have to go do it again for CXFS, which is the clustered version of XFS. And that's going to be really interesting. And I'll just... Well, CXFS does caching. I don't know if you're in the GFS talk. It's a... there still is one server. There's one place where XFS is running, and all the other machines use Fibre Channel to get to the disk, but they do direct I/O between their memory and file data blocks. All metadata is mediated through the server, but CXFS lets you do things like move the server while the system is running. And which means you've got to do lots of stuff with stopping people getting through the file system interface, holding them up, moving stuff out from under them, putting other stuff in its place. And a lot of that is very file system interface specific. That's one of the areas where things are quite different. So,
are you going to open source the CXF part? Because last time I talked to your engineers, there was some discussion about that.
I doubt it. One day, probably. But currently it's seen as something we can actually make money on. So, and SGI, as you all know, probably needs money. Probably that's not going to be open source, which is going to make it really interesting. It's probably going to get tied to specific kernel versions and all sorts of weird stuff, but it'll be... Don't hold your breath. I believe it will be, yes. And there's two aspects to that. I mean, one aspect of it, you need to be able to understand the labels on the disk, and that's not too hard to do, to implement from scratch. XVM understands clusters is one of the other reasons for doing it. And that's a lot of management code. But the actual labeling of disks could be done in a much smaller piece of code, I suspect. But yes, it will be open source.
The main incentive for porting XVM will be the XFS cluster.
And just so people, and so SGI SGI customers can move disk farms around between systems.
Could you repeat that? I couldn't hear the answer.
Okay, so the Linux LVM plus MD provides most of the functionality we have in XVM, SGI. So there's no real point in porting that to get an extra volume manager. The incentive for porting XVM will be CXFS support and being able to move disk farms from Iris boxes to Linux boxes.
Oh. Thank you.
You never know, maybe you guys do it better.
Huh?
You never know, maybe you guys do some part of it better.
We'll see.
It supports more ways of gluing disks together, I think, than the open source stuff in Linux does at the moment. You can stack things three ways from Sunday, or whatever you want to call it, which doesn't always make that much sense, but you can do it. So, you know, you can Stripe on top of RAID, on top of Stripe. Basically, it's a complete stacking implementation. Any more questions? Okay. Thank you.